is impossible to decipher. Omar is speaking, something about coming to headquarters, a meeting, but I don't hear the words. My mind is racing. Did Peter find Matt's picture? Impossible, because he'd have already gone to security. Did he see that I deleted the file? Again, security. He wouldn't be standing here talking to me. Vivian? I blink, try to focus on the conversation, Omar's voice in my ear. See you later?
Yeah, I murmur. See you later.
I hang up the phone and put my hands in my lap so Peter won't see them shaking. Then I turn to him, wait for him to say something because I can't make my mouth work. He takes a moment before responding.
You got on the phone before I could catch you. I went into Athena this morning, had a look around, figured you could use a hand, someone to lighten the load.
Oh, God. I should have figured he might do that.
I found a file. It had been deleted.
My kids, I see each of their faces in my mind, their smiles, looks of joy and innocence.
Called friends.
Luke's old enough to understand. How many times have we told him not to lie? Now he's going to know his father's whole life, his parents' marriage, all of it was a lie.
5 photos.
And Ella. Ella worships Matt. He's her hero. What will this do to her?
Meeting at 10 with the Bureau.
Chase and Caleb, too young to understand. Too young to have memories of our family before this.
Omar will be there.
Omar. Omar knows Matt. I introduced the two when Omar and I started spending so much time together. He's been to our house, we've been to his. Maybe Peter didn't recognize him, but Omar would. And, in any case, if I'm in the room when they show his picture, I need to pretend. Feign surprise.
Vivian!
I blink. Peter's looking at me with raised eyebrows. I'm sorry, I say. What?
You'll be there? At the meeting?
Yeah, yes, of course. He hesitates a moment longer, a concerned look on his face, then leaves back to his office. I stare at my screen, try to remember how I felt when I first saw Matt's picture, because I'm going to have to replicate it. Disbelief, confusion, fear. Then my rationalization. He's being targeted. I could ask to see the file now, pretend to see it for the first time in front of Peter. But better to let a bigger audience see my reaction, see me process these emotions. If I can do it convincingly. Not if, when. I need to do it convincingly. Because if I give them even the slightest indication I already knew, it won't take them long to figure out that it wasn't Yuri who deleted the file. That it was me. Peter comes back at 5 minutes before 10. We walk down the hall together to the suite that houses the CIC executive offices.
You okay, Vivian? He asks as we walk, peering at me over his glasses.
Fine, I say. In my mind, I'm already in the conference room, seeing Matt's picture.
If you need more time off, more time with Caleb,
I shake my head. Words won't come right now. I should have done what Matt said. I should have turned him in. He's going to be discovered anyway, and now I'm in trouble, too. Why didn't I listen? We walk in, and the secretary ushers us into the conference room. I've been here a few times before, and each time it's as intimidating as the last. Darker than it needs to be, heavy gleaming wood table, expensive leather chairs, 4 clocks on the wall. D.C., Moscow, Beijing, Tehran. Omar's there at the table, along with 2 other bureau guys in suits. His bosses, I think. He nods at me, but not with his usual grin. Just a nod doesn't take his eyes off me. I sit down on the other side of the table and wait. Peter goes to the computer, logs on, and I see the large screen on the wall come to life. I watch him navigate to Athena, launch the program, and then I stare at the clock, the one that shows the local time. I watch the second hand tick around, focus on that, because I know if I think of Matt, of the kids, I'll fall apart. Everything will fall apart, and I'll never get through this. And I have to get through this. Tina strides in moments later, followed by Nick, the chief of CIC Russia, and two assistants, each in a black suit. She gives curt nods around the room and takes her seat at the head of the table. There's an unpleasant look on her face, unpleasant and intimidating. "So, we're inside laptop number 5, she says. "More luck than the first 4, I hope?" Her eyes scan the room and land on Peter. He clears his throat. "Yes, ma'am." He gestures up at the screen, the Athena homepage. He double-clicks on the icon with Yuri's name. And moments later, I see the mirror image of Yuri's laptop, the blue bubbles, so familiar at this point. My eyes go to the last row of icons, the place where the folder should be and isn't. Peter's talking, but I'm not hearing the words. I'm focusing on how I'll feign surprise, trying to keep my face impassive because I know Omar's watching me. I watch as the screen morphs into strings of characters, the data recovery program at work. Moments later, the folder reappears. Friends. This is it. Life as I know it is over. I try to push my kids' faces from my mind, breathe through my nose, in and out. He double-clicks, and I see the list of 5 images. He moves the cursor up to the top, changes the view from text to large icons. At once, 5 faces appear on the screen. I'm dimly aware of round glasses on the first, bright orange hair on the second, but my eyes focus on the third, on Matt. Only it's not Matt anymore. Chapter 8. It's someone who looks like Matt. At least a little. Dark hair, dark eyes, straight smile. And it definitely looks like the picture of Matt that had been in this very place, with this very file name. Same tilt of the head, same distance from the camera, same background. But the features are unmistakably different. It's a completely different person. Not my husband at all. I blink. Once, twice. Disbelief courses through me. Then it morphs slowly into a wave of relief. An overwhelming, utterly exhilarating wave of relief. Matt did it. He fixed this, just like he said he would. I don't know how he did it, but his picture is gone. Our family is still intact. We're safe. I finally pull my eyes away from the picture, shift them left to the first and second pictures, the man in the round glasses, the woman with the orange hair. My breath catches in my throat. The man has sharper features than yesterday, a squarer chin. The woman has higher cheekbones, a broader forehead. These are different people, too. I look right to the last 2 images. The pale woman and the man with the spiky hair, even though I already know what I'll see. Similar features, similar camera angles, but not the same people as the day before. Oh, God. Matt was one thing, but 4 other sleepers? My chest feels tight, a crushing pressure inside, and I don't know why either. I deleted the other 4 pictures when I deleted Matt's. I was willing to hide them to protect my husband. So why does it bother me now, seeing the pictures replaced? How is this any different? I hear voices through the fog in my head. A conversation, Tina and Peter. Whether these could really be sleepers. I blink again, try to focus. "But the file isn't encrypted," Tina says. "True, and all our intelligence indicates it should be," Peter replies. "But it was deleted." Tina cocks her head, frowning. "Some sort of mistake on Yuri's part?" Peter nods. "Could be.
The file was accidentally loaded, or the encryption failed, or something along those lines. And Yuri's response was to delete it.
Not realizing it would still be there, Tina adds.
Exactly.
And that we'd find it.
He nods again.
She raises an index finger to her lips, bright red polish catching the light, taps once, twice. Then she looks over at the bureau contingent, the three agents sitting in a row, dark suits, hands clasped in front of them.
Thoughts?
The one in the center clears his throat and speaks.
Seems reasonable to approach this as a lead to Russian sleepers.
Agreed.
We'll do what we can to identify the individuals, ma'am.
Tina offers a curt nod. There's a throbbing in my head. These aren't sleepers. They might not even be real people. Digitally altered compositions of individuals, leads the Bureau will be chasing in vain. And ultimately, I'm responsible. I disclosed classified information. I did it to protect my family, sure. But now we've lost our insight into the identities of four other Russian agents. I grip the armrest of my chair, suddenly lightheaded. What have I done? There's more conversation. I try hard to focus. Hear Yuri's name.
In Moscow, Peter says.
Do we know where in Moscow? Tina asks.
We don't. We'll certainly devote extra resources in the coming days to determining his whereabouts.
The computer, do we have any location information?
No. He hasn't used it to connect to the internet.
He's here, my mind screams. In the U.S., in our own metro area, on false papers, stopping by a Northwest D.C. bank courtyard every few months or whenever my husband signals. I clench my jaw shut, and when I look up, I see Omar watching me, unblinking, unsmiling. The rest of the conversation fades away until all I can hear is the blood pounding in my ears. I'm in the hallway after the meeting, attempting a hasty retreat back to my desk, when Omar catches up to me, half jogging to do so. He falls into step beside me. My heart's racing. I don't know what to say to him, what he's going to say to me, how I can possibly answer his questions.
You okay, Vivian?
I glance over and he looks concerned, or maybe fake concerned. My mouth is suddenly very dry. Yeah, just got a lot on my mind right now. A few more steps, still in sync, and then we're at the elevator. I push the button, watch it light up, hope the elevator arrives quickly.
Family stuff? He asks.
The way he says it, the studiously blank look on his face makes me think of an interrogation. One of those early, innocuous questions designed to build rapport, or maybe entrap. I look away to the closed elevator doors. Yeah, Ella's been sick. Caleb's had some medical appointments. I trail off, wondering irrationally if I'm somehow jinxing their health with these lies. Karma and all that. Out of the corner of my eye, I see him look straight ahead, too.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Then he glances over at me. We're friends, remember, if you ever need help with anything. I give a quick nod, look up at the numbers above the elevator doors. I watch them light up in sequence, but slow, much too slow. What did that mean, if I ever need help with anything? We stand side by side and wait. Finally, there's a ding and then the doors open. I walk in and Omar follows. I press the button for my floor and then I glance over at him. I should say something, make some conversation. We can't have a silent elevator ride. That wouldn't be normal. I'm trying to think of what to say when he speaks.
There's a mole, you know.
What? He's eyeing me.
A mole. In CIC.
Why is he telling me this? Is it me they suspect? I struggle to keep my face impassive. I didn't know that.
He nods, the Bureau's investigating one.
It can't be me, though, can it? What's the appropriate response here? That's crazy.
It is.
He goes quiet, and I have no idea what to say next. In the silence, I feel certain he can hear my heartbeat.
Look, I vouched for you, he says, speaking quickly and softly. I said you're my friend, that there's no way you'd do this, that you shouldn't be a priority in the investigation.
I feel the motion come to a stop. I'm not breathing. I'm absolutely frozen. The elevator doors open.
But something's going on. I can see it.
He lowers his voice, and they're going to investigate you eventually. I force myself to look at him. There's concern on his face and sympathy, and for some reason that feels almost more unsettling than pure suspicion. He puts a hand out on one side, tripping the sensors, holding the doors open for me. I step out of the elevator, expecting him to follow. When he doesn't, I turn back. His eyes are boring into me.
If you're in trouble, he says, removing his hand, allowing the doors to begin sliding closed, you know where to find me.
The rest of the day is a blur. Our bay of cubicles is abuzz, chatter about the five pictures, how best to track down Yuri, strategy sessions about how to get to his handler, the elusive ringleader. And I want nothing more than for it to all just disappear. To have time alone with my thoughts. Time to process everything that just happened. The conversation with Omar, for one thing. Why did he warn me there's a mole? And why did he act like he suspects I've been compromised? If he thinks I'm the double, why is he standing between me and an investigation? None of it makes sense. And then there's Matt and the pictures. I don't know how he did it. He wouldn't have access to Yuri's computer himself, right? It seems more likely he talked to Yuri. But Matt wouldn't betray me that way, would he? He promised he'd never tell. A heaviness is settling down around me, a darkness. All five of those pictures changed. If the goal was to protect our family, the only one that needed to change was his. Changing all five did more than protect our family. It protected the sleeper program. I look at the picture on the corner of my desk, the one from our wedding. I stare into Matt's eyes until they look almost taunting. Are you trying to do what's best for us? I think. Or for them? I found out I was pregnant 2 months to the day after I made the jump to working Russia CI. I remember sitting on the edge of the bathtub, staring at the little stick, the blue line that was slowly darkening, comparing it to the picture on the box, disbelief and excitement coursing through me in waves. I'd had all these cute ideas about how to break the news to Matt. Things I'd heard about, read about online, mentally filed away over the years. But seeing that line, knowing there was a baby in there, our baby, I couldn't wait. I practically burst out of the bathroom. He was in the closet, buttoning his shirt. I hesitated for a moment in front of him, then held up the stick, a big smile on my face. His hands went still. He looked at the stick, then at my face, his eyes growing wide. Really? He said. And when I nodded, he broke into the biggest smile, one I knew I'd never forget. I'd had a niggling fear ever since the Bahamas that maybe he didn't want kids as much as I'd thought, as much as I wanted them. But that smile made any lingering doubt disappear. It was pure joy. He was the happiest I'd ever seen him. We're going to have a baby, he breathed, and I could hear the same wonderment I was feeling. I nodded, and he came toward me, wrapped his arms around me, kissed me like I was suddenly something fragile, and I felt my heart swelling like a balloon, threatening to float right out of my chest. I spent the day at work in a happy stupor, caught myself staring at my computer screen for hours on end. The same page, not really seeing anything. When no one was looking, I opened the online employee handbook, navigated to the section on maternity leave, then the one about leaves of absence, hit the print button, tucked the sheets into my bag. I left work early, had a nice dinner at home with Matt, one he cooked. He must have asked a half dozen times how I felt and if I needed anything. After I changed into some sweats, I pulled out the handbook pages, brought them over to the couch where Matt was sitting, flipping through shows on the DVR. He paused and looked over at them, then at me. There was an expression on his face I couldn't quite read. He settled on a show, one of those cooking competitions, and I watched with him, curled up beside him, my head on his chest. When it was almost over, when the contestants were all lined up in front of the judge's table, he paused it. "We need a house," he said. "What?" I'd heard what he said, but it was so out of the blue, I felt like I needed to hear it again for it to make sense. "A house? We can't raise a kid here." He gestured around us, the main floor of our townhouse. I looked around. Living room, kitchen, dining room. I could see every inch in one glance. Never had it seemed so small to me before. But at the same time, we weren't tied down. We didn't have the weight of a mortgage. We lived close to the city. I'd never felt the urge to buy. I didn't think he had either. "Well, the first few years," I started to say. "We need space, a yard, a real neighborhood." He looked so adamant, so worried. "And those would all be good things to have eventually." I shrugged. "No harm in looking, I guess." By the following week, we had a realtor, a mousy man with patchy gray hair that I stared at from the back seat of his sedan during all those long drives around the D.C. area. We started out close to the city, within our price range. The houses were small, fixer-uppers for the most part. I could tell from the look on Matt's face as we walked through that he hated them. Hated them all. "That stairway wouldn't be safe for kids," he said. "We need more space, no room for a swing set." It was always something. So we went farther from the city, where houses got bigger, but not necessarily better, or better, but not bigger. Then we upped our price range. I thought that brought us some viable options. Frustratingly out of date, perhaps, but livable. Cramped, but we could make do. In the suburbs, but it's not like either of us commuted on public transportation. In each one, though, Matt found something unacceptable. A landing that would be dangerous for toddlers. Backing to a creek. What if the kids fall in? I'd never seen him so picky about anything. "We're not going to find anything perfect," I said. "I just want what's best for the baby. For any other kids we have, too," he said. And he gave me a look. "Isn't that what you want, too?" If the realtor hadn't been so passive, and if he didn't stand to make such a hefty sum whenever we did make a decision, I swear he would have left us. But still we looked. Raised our budget once more, looked even farther out. Counties that were half suburban, half rural. The exurbs, our realtor explained. Matt started to look more interested. He liked the big colonials, the big yards, the neighborhoods full of kids on bikes. I cringed at the prices, the distance from the city. "Just think how great this would be for the kids," he said. And how could I argue with that? Then we found one. Great layout, updated, on a cul-de-sac, backed to trees. I could tell by the look on his face Matt thought it was perfect. I liked it, too. I could see us raising a family there. And even though I wouldn't admit it, I was so, so done with the search. I wanted to be home, reading baby books. We decided that night that we'd put in an offer. The next morning, I walked downstairs, and Matt had his laptop open. I could tell from his face that something was wrong.
He looked like he hadn't slept. "It's the schools," he explained. "They're horrible." I walked around and looked. He had the ratings up on the screen. He was right. They were. "We need good schools," he said. He turned back to his screen, minimized that window, and another appeared. A house. A small one, rather unimpressive. The kind we'd been looking at during the beginning of our search. "It's in Bethesda," Matt said. "The schools are all tens." There was excitement in his voice, the kind I'd last heard when we'd walked into the perfect colonial. "This is our house, Viv."
"It's small. You hated the small houses."
"I know," he shrugged. "So we'll be a little cramped. We won't have the biggest yard. I won't get everything I want. But the schools are awesome. It'd be worth it for the kids."
I took a closer look at the screen. "Did you see the price?"
"Yeah, it's not that much more than the last one, the one we were ready to buy."
I could feel my heart doing flip-flops. Not that much more? It was nearly 50 grand more.
And the last house was already way above our budget. And our budget had already increased way beyond what I thought we could afford. There was no way we could afford this house. "We can afford it," he said, reading my mind. He opened up another screen, a spreadsheet. "See?"
It was a budget. He'd budgeted everything.
"I'm due for a raise soon. You're going to get step increases every year, promotions eventually. We can make this work."
My breathing was almost jagged. "It only works if I stay at my job." There was an awkward silence.
"You want to quit?"
"Well, no, not quit. Maybe a leave of absence?" "It's something we've never talked about, I guess. I just assumed I'd stay home for a while. And I assumed it was something he wanted, too. Both our mothers stayed home while we were young. We didn't have any family nearby. We weren't going to put our baby in daycare, were we?"
"You're not the stay-at-home type, are you?" he asked.
The stay-at-home type? What was that supposed to mean? I'm not talking about staying home for good. It was like that day at the beach all over again. That feeling that I wasn't good enough, that he thought he'd married someone better. Just for a while.
"But you love your job."
"I didn't love it, not anymore. Not since I moved to the Russia account. I didn't like the stress, the long hours, the feeling that no matter how hard I worked, I wasn't actually accomplishing anything. And I knew I'd like it even less with a baby in the mix. I love the idea of making a difference, but ever since I started working Russia..."
"You've got the best job in the agency, don't you? The one everybody wants?" I hesitated.
"It's a good account, yeah."
"And you'd leave it to stay home with a baby all day?"
I stared at him. "Our baby. And yeah, maybe I would, I don't know."
He shook his head and more awkward silence filled the room. "If you're not working, how would we save for college? How would we travel with the kids, do anything like that?" he finally asked. For the first time since getting that positive test, I started to feel nauseous. Before I could reply, he spoke again. "Viv, the schools are all tens. Tens! How awesome would that be?"
He reached out, placed a hand on my abdomen, gave me a meaningful look.
"I just want to do what's best for our baby."
And in the silence that followed hung the unspoken question, "Don't you?" Of course I did. How was I already feeling like I wasn't a good enough mother? I looked back at the screen. The house was back up. The house that already felt like a weight and we hadn't even seen it yet. When I spoke, my voice was strangled. "Let's go take a look." I get home later than usual that night. I see them all at the kitchen table as soon as I walk in, the remnants of spaghetti and meatballs in bright plastic bowls and on high chair trays.
"Mommy!"
Ella yells at the same time Luke calls out, "Hi, Mom!" The twins are shirtless, their faces covered in spaghetti sauce, little bits of pasta clinging to odd spots, foreheads, shoulders, hair. Matt gives me a smile, like everything's normal, like none of this ever happened, then gets up and heads to the stove, starts to scoop out some dinner onto a plate for me. I leave my jacket and bag by the door and walk into the kitchen, a smile pasted on my face. I kiss the top of Ella's head, then Luke's, wave at the twins on either end of the table. Chase gives me a toothy grin back and bangs his tray, sending droplets of sauce flying. I pull out my chair and sit down at the same time Matt sets the plate of spaghetti in front of me. He sits across from me and I look at him, feeling my expression harden. "Thanks," I say. "Everything okay?" he asks carefully. I avoid the question, turn to Ella instead. "How are you feeling, sweetie?"
"Better."
"Good." I glance up at Matt briefly. He's watching me. I turn my attention to Luke. "How was your day at school?"
"Fine."
I try to think of something else to ask him, something specific, about a test or show and tell or something like that, but I don't know what to ask. So instead, I just take a bite of lukewarm spaghetti, studiously avoiding Matt's eyes. "Is everything okay?" he asks again. I chew slowly. "I thought it wasn't going to be, but lo and behold, everything is just fine." I don't take my eyes off him. He understands. I can see it. "I'm glad to hear that," he says. There's an awkward pause. Finally, Ella breaks the silence.
"Daddy, I'm all done," she says.
We both look at her. "Wait till Mommy's done too, sweetheart," Matt says. I shake my head. "Don't worry about it." He hesitates, and I give him a look. "Let her go. Let them all go, so we can talk." "Okay," he says to me, and then to Ella. "Bring your bowl to the sink, please."
"Can I be excused too, Dad?"
Luke asks. "Sure, buddy." Luke and Ella both leave the table. Matt gets some wet paper towels, starts wiping off Chase's face, his hands. I take a few more bites, watching as he cleans Chase, lifts him out of the chair, puts him down on the floor. He glances at me briefly before turning his attention to Caleb's face. Finally, I set down my fork. No appetite, no point in eating anymore. "How did you do it?" I ask. "Switch the images?" "Yeah." He's focused on Caleb's hands now, wiping between chubby little fingers. "I told you I'd get you out of it." "But how did you do it?" He doesn't answer, doesn't look at me, just keeps wiping Caleb's hands. I grit my teeth. "Can you please answer my question?" He lifts Caleb out of the seat, sits back down with him on his lap. Caleb sticks his fingers into his mouth, starts sucking on them. "I told you it's better if you don't know details." "Don't give me that. Was it you? Or did you tell someone?" He starts bouncing Caleb on one knee. "I told Yuri." A jolt runs through me, a rush of betrayal. "You said you wouldn't tell." There's a flash of confusion on his face. "What?" "You promised you'd never tell." He blinks, and then there's a look of recognition. "No, Viv. I promised I'd never tell the authorities." I stare at him. Caleb's squirming, straining to get out of Matt's lap. "I had to tell Yuri. I had no choice," he says. Caleb lets out a wail. He's squirming harder now. "I'll be right back," Matt murmurs, and leaves the room with Caleb on his hip. I look down at my hands, my wedding ring. Is this what it feels like to be cheated on? I thought, when I married Matt, I would be lucky enough to never experience that feeling. I couldn't in a million years picture him ever betraying me. I place my right hand over my left, and the ring is gone from my sight. He comes back a moment later, alone, sits back down. I listen to the sounds from the other room, Luke and Ella playing Go Fish. I lower my voice, lean forward. So, now the Russians know I disclosed classified information to you.
Yuri knows.
I shake my head. How could you do that? If I could have fixed it myself, I would have. But I didn't have a way to do that. The only way was to go to Yuri. And change all 5 pictures? He leans back in his chair, looks at me. What are you saying? I don't answer him. What am I supposed to say? That I'm not sure if he's really loyal to me? None of this would have happened if you'd just turned me in. He's looking at me like he's the one who's been betrayed. But he's right. And I can feel some of the anger inside me starting to morph into guilt. He did tell me to turn him in. He didn't go to Yuri right away. Those pictures didn't change the first day. If he was worried more about the program than about me, he'd have done something that very first day. So everything's okay now? I finally say. I try to push the faces of the other 4 sleepers from my mind, the fact that they're going to remain hidden because of me. You deleted the file, Viv. You deleted the pictures first. We're safe? He looks away, and I know before he speaks that we're not. Well, not exactly. Not exactly, I force myself to think. Because they'll still be able to tell I deleted the file? I picture security interrogating me, telling me they discovered I erased it. I can say it was an accident. I had no idea I did it. It might be a stretch, and it might put me under some suspicion, albeit temporarily. But it's not like they'll find Matt's picture on there. Yeah, he says, but not just that. Athena keeps a log of user activity. How does he know the name Athena? I'm sure I've never mentioned it. So there's a record of exactly what you saw on Yuri's computer, Viv. In theory, someone could go in and essentially watch you navigate around Yuri's computer, see the files you opened. They could see me open your picture. Yeah. So your photo still exists on the server? Yes. That means the other 4 pictures exist too. It wouldn't be too late to get the real photos into the hands of the FBI. I still have a chance to come clean, to let the agency know about the other 4 sleepers and Matt too, to do the right thing. No harm done, right? Maybe they'd be able to excuse the fact that I deleted the file, an impulsive act by a frightened wife. Except, not really. Because there's only one explanation for those 5 pictures changing. I told the Russians details about a highly classified program. I committed treason. That very fact would land me in prison. Fear turns the blood running through my veins to ice. I think of Omar, the way he's looked at me the past couple of days. There's a mole in CIC. If I'm the one they suspect, all they need to confirm their suspicions is sitting right on that server. There's a way out of this, Matt says, a way to erase it. He looks troubled, reticent. How? My voice is barely a whisper. He reaches into his pocket, pulls out a flash drive, a small rectangle, black plastic. He holds it up. There's a program on here. It'll erase your activity history for the past 2 days. I stare at it. That would wipe out any evidence of me finding Matt's picture. They'd have nothing to use to convict me, to take me away from my kids. Yours and everyone else's, he adds. It'll set the servers back 2 days. I look up at him. Set the servers back 2 days. 2 days of lost work for the entire agency, all those people, all that work. But it's not much in the scheme of things, is it? It would keep my family together. It would erase Matt's picture once and for all. It would erase the four other sleepers' pictures, too, but there's not a question in my mind I want the Russians to use it. I don't even have to think about that. I'd let those other four sleepers escape detection in exchange for keeping my family together. I know it's wrong, and I feel like a snake just for thinking it. But this is my kids we're talking about. So what? I ask. They'll just load it on? Well, that's the thing. He looks at me. You would load it on. Chapter 9. He sets the flash drive down on the table, and I look at it like it's something that might detonate. There is nothing I can do with that. The computers are modified. I don't have a port. There's one in the restricted access room. I stare at him. Have I ever mentioned the restricted access room? I certainly haven't said anything about the computers in there. But he's right, isn't he? There is a computer set aside for uploading data from the field. Well, it doesn't matter. That computer's password protected. I don't have the credentials. You don't have to. The program runs on its own. It just needs to be plugged in. The magnitude of what he's asking stuns me. You're asking me to load something onto the agency's computer network. It'll erase the evidence that you deleted the file. It'll erase the pictures, too. All five of them. I look away. Then I say the words at the forefront of my mind, even though I know I shouldn't. You're a Russian agent, asking me to load a program onto a CIA network. I'm your husband, trying to keep you out of jail. By asking me to do something that could get me locked up for the rest of my life. He reaches across the table, places a hand on mine. If they discover what you did, you're going away for a really long time as it is. I hear Ella in the other room.
That's not fair, she's yelling.
You're right, I think, staring at the flash drive. It's not fair. None of this is fair.
Daddy, she screeches. Luke cheated. I did not, Luke shouts.
I'm still staring at the flash drive. I can feel Matt's eyes on me. Neither of us is getting up to go in there to referee. The kids continue arguing, but quieter now. When their conversation returns to normal, I pull my hand out from under Matt's and clasp them together. What's on it for real? Something that's going to let the Russians into our systems? He shakes his head. No, absolutely not. I swear to you, it's just a program that will reset the servers to their state 2 days ago.
How do you know?
I checked. I ran diagnostics on it. That's all it is.
And why should I believe you?
I don't say the words, but I don't have to. I'm sure he can read it all over my face. If you don't do this, you're going to jail. His expression looks completely open, honest, and scared, too. This is a way out. I look back down at the flash drive, willing it to disappear, wishing this all could just disappear. I have a sense that I'm spiraling down deeper and deeper, and I'm powerless to stop it. Is this really something I could do? I raise my head to give him a long look. His words are echoing in my head. I ran diagnostics on it. Let me see. Confusion clouds his features. What? You said you ran diagnostics on it. Let me see. He recoils like he's been slapped. You don't believe me. I want to see it for myself. We stare at each other, unblinking, until he finally speaks. Fine. He stands, leaves the room, and I get up to follow. He goes to the storage area behind the stairs, turns on the light, reaches for the screwdriver, the same one I used. I watch as he pries open the floorboard, removes the laptop. He turns around, gives me a long look, one I can't read, then brushes past me, back to the table. He opens the laptop and sits down in front of it. I stand behind him, watching the screen. The white bar appears. The cursor flashes.
I look down at the keyboard, follow his fingers as they strike the keys, slowly and deliberately. A pattern I recognize, one of his usual passwords, the kids' birthdays. He taps a few extra keys at the end, and it takes a moment for realization to dawn. It's our anniversary date. He was thinking about us after all.
You're not going to understand any of this, are you? He asks without turning around. And I'm grateful his back's to me because he's right. I'm not a tech person. The details won't be clear. But it's not about that. It's about how he acts right now, what he shows me. I'll understand enough to know whether he really ran diagnostics on it or whether that was a lie. And maybe that's enough.
I know more than you think I do. He opens a program, types a command, and text starts to roll down the screen.
A log of user activity, he murmurs. He points to a line, today's date, then another, a timestamp from a few hours earlier.
He scrolls down the screen, gestures to a section of text.
The contents of the drive, he says.
I scan the text, much of it indecipherable, but bits and pieces make sense, align with what Matt said. Nothing suggests it's anything more. And most important, the date and timestamp. The fact that he had something to show me. He ran diagnostics on the drive, just like he said. He wasn't lying. He turns in his chair and looks up at me. There's hurt on his face, and it sends guilt washing over me. Do you believe me now? I walk around to the other side of the table, sit in the chair across from him. I hesitate before speaking.
They're good, you know, agency people. What if they trace this back to me?
They won't, he says quietly. How can you be sure?
Think of the things I told you. The things the Russians know.
He reaches over the table, puts his hands over mine.
They're good, too.
I don't sleep that night again. Instead, I wander the house, my heart aching. I watch the kids sleep, the rise and fall of their chests, the faces that look even younger in slumber. I pad through the halls, looking at each photo on the walls, all those fleeting moments, the happy smiles, the artwork hanging on the fridge with magnets, the toys lying idle in the darkness, waiting. I just want this all to continue. Normal life. But the fact of the matter is, I could go to jail. It's pretty much a certainty now if they find out what I did. Disclosing compartmented information, jeopardizing agency operations. And, oh, how much I'll miss if that happens. Emotion wells up inside me just thinking about it. Caleb's first steps, his first words. Ella losing her first tooth, the excitement of the tooth fairy. Dance recitals, t-ball, learning to ride bikes. Most of all those little moments, cuddling them when they've had a nightmare or when they're sick. Hearing, I love you, Mommy, and what they learned at school, what they're excited about, scared about. Sure, this will mean the Bureau won't catch sleepers it otherwise might have. But in the scheme of things, how much does it matter? There were literally dozens of sleepers at my wedding. This problem is so much bigger than we realize. 5 is a drop in the bucket. I'm sitting on the couch in the pre-dawn darkness when Matt comes downstairs. He turns on the kitchen light, blinks as his eyes adjust. He walks to the coffee maker, presses the button. I watch him in silence. Finally, he notices me, stops, and stares. I hold his gaze. Then, slowly, I lift up my hand, flash drive between thumb and forefinger. Tell me what I need to know. I'm going to do this. The enormity of it is almost overpowering. I watch in a daze as he wipes down the flash drive with a little cleaning cloth, the kind he uses to clear smudges from his sunglasses.
For the fingerprints, he says.
He places it into the false bottom of a double-walled travel coffee mug. Shiny. Metallic. Something I've never seen before. Where was this? Where does he keep these things? How have I been so blind? All you do is plug it in, he says, handing me the mug. I take it from him. I can see my reflection in it, distorted. It's me, but it looks like someone else. There's a USB port in the front of the computer terminal.
Okay.
I continue to stare at the reflection in the tumbler, this image of me that isn't really me. Plug it in, wait at least 5 minutes, no more than 10, then remove it. In 10, the servers start resetting. If the drive's still connected when the reset's complete, they'll be able to trace it back to the computer. 5 minutes? I have to sit there for 5 minutes with the drive attached? What if someone sees? I'll wait till after hours, then. He shakes his head. Can't. The computer has to be logged on. Logged on? His words fill me with fear. That means business hours. Peter's the one with the credentials. He usually logs on to that computer in the morning, locks it for the day, then logs off again before he leaves. This seems like such a risk, what he's asking me to do. What if someone sees me do it? That can't happen, he says. And I can see the fear on his face, the first little tremor of uncertainty I've seen since he showed me the flash drive. Don't let that happen. The tumbler sits in the cup holder beside me as I drive to the office. I grip it tightly on the trek in from the parking lot, even tighter as I enter the lobby and see the American flag hanging from the rafters. Every ounce of my concentration is dedicated to looking calm, impassive. I pass 3 signs on the way in, I never noticed there were so many, with the list of prohibited items. A long list, anything and everything electronic. Even if the flash drive were blank, bringing it in would still be prohibited, and it's not like I can say I didn't know. I wait in line for the turnstiles. Off to the right, there's a woman about my age pulled aside for a spot check. Ron's going through her bag. On the left, an older man's being wanded, another spot check. I avert my gaze. I can feel beads of sweat pricking my forehead, my upper lip. When it's my turn, I hold my badge over the reader, enter my code on the touchpad. The turnstiles unlock. Allow me to pass. The sensors sound, a low-pitched beep, and 2 officers I don't recognize look in my direction. My heart is galloping away. So loud, I'm sure the people around me must be able to hear it. I paste on a confused look, just for a split second, then smile, hold up the mug in their direction. Here, it's just this. Don't worry, it's not electronics. These sensors, the ones that can detect electronic devices, are notoriously fickle. One of the officers walks over. He takes a wand, runs it up and down me over my bag. It beeps only at the tumbler. With a bored look, he waves me in. I give him a smile, a nod. I continue down the hall, even pace, even gait. When I'm out of his sight, I wipe the dampness from my brow with the back of a trembling hand. I badge into the vault, enter my code. The heavy door unlatches and I push it open. I see Patricia right away. I offer her a smile as I pass. A good morning, just like any other day. Then I walk back to my cubicle and log on. Normal routine, normal greetings, everything's normal. I sit at my desk and stare at the door. Restricted access. Large red letters. The readers beside it, one that scans badges, the other fingerprints. There's a program open on my screen, but I'm not looking at it. Not running my searches, not opening my emails. Just staring at the door. A few minutes after 9, Peter walks over. I watch as he holds his badge to one of the readers, enters a code, then touches his finger to the other, holds it there. He enters, shuts the heavy door behind him. Minutes later, the door opens again, and he leaves. I turn my gaze to the tumbler sitting in front of me on the desk. The computer's logged on. I could do it any time. I need to do it. I reach for the tumbler, close my fingers around it. It's almost hard to stand up from my chair, make my legs walk toward the door. I badge in, hold my finger to the reader. The lock disengages and I pull open the heavy door. Inside it's dark. I flip on the light switch. It's a small space, smaller even than Peter's office. Two computers, side by side on a table, screens angled away from each other. A third set against the opposite wall. It's this one that draws my attention. I see the USB drive on the front. I sit down at one of the other two computers, set the tumbler down in front of me. Log on. If anyone else comes in, I need to look like I'm working. I pull up the most compartmented piece of information I have access to, one that only a handful of people in the whole agency can see. Something so sensitive that I'd have no choice but to ask any newcomer to leave to come back when I'm finished. Then I take a soft breath, unscrew the bottom of the tumbler. Once open, I see the flash drive. I pull my sleeve over my hand, shake the drive out into it, screw the bottom back on. I'm still for a moment listening, but all is quiet. And then I'm out of the chair, over to the third computer. With my sleeve covering my fingertips, I insert the drive quickly and easily. The end of it flickers orange almost immediately. I'm back in my chair mere seconds later, shaking. I've never been so terrified in all my life. Everything's still quiet. I look at the clock at the bottom of my screen. 5 minutes. That's all I need. I just need to be alone in here for 5 minutes, remove the drive, stick it back into the tumbler, and this is all over and done with, like it never happened. I glance back at the drive, the end of it glowing orange. What's it doing right now? Worming its way into the servers, I guess. Getting ready to erase everything from the past 2 days. That's it, though, right? God, I hope that's it. A minute passes, and it feels like an eternity. I'm doing the fractions in my head. 1/5 of the way there. 20%. And then there's a beep outside the door, a badge being held to the reader. I go still, then turn toward the door. Be calm. I must be calm. 4 minutes. I just need 4 more minutes. The door opens, and it's Peter again. Oh, God, it's Peter. Fear is clutching my insides. He's read into everything I am. I have no excuse for keeping him out, do I? He's going to sit down at that computer next to me. And how can I possibly get to the other computer? Remove that drive. Hi, Vivian, he says. Pleasant. Normal. I hope he can't see how panicked I am, how utterly terrified. Hey. I fight to keep my voice calm. He walks in, sits at the terminal beside me, starts typing his passwords. I'm so incredibly conscious of the flash drive in the computer behind us. There's no reason he'd use that computer, right? But what if he notices it? I look at the clock. It's been 3 minutes now, 60%. 2 more and... Vivian, Peter says. Yeah? I turn to him. Could you excuse me for a few minutes? I need to check a new piece of intel. Eagle Justice. A compartment I don't have. He's doing exactly what I was planning to do. Kick out anyone without the right clearances. I look back at the clock. Still 3 minutes. I swear time isn't moving the way it should. Could you just give me a few more minutes to finish up? I'm almost done. Wish I could, but I need to take a look at this before the morning management meeting. Nick's orders. No. No, this can't be happening. What am I supposed to do? What in the world am I supposed to do right now? Vivian? Right. Sure, let me just log off. If you could just lock it for now, I really need to look at this quickly. I hesitate.
My brain's failing me right now, not coming up with a single thing to do besides just acquiesce. Okay. I lock my screen, Control-Alt-Delete. I stand, and as I'm opening the door to leave, my eyes drift to the flash drive, still attached, the end of it still glowing orange. I walk back to my desk, sit down in a daze. My eyes find the clock, 5 minutes, and then settle on the door. My mind seems paralyzed, unable to come up with anything to do. I think back to Matt's words this morning. 5 minutes, no more than 10. The servers start resetting. 6 minutes now, and still the door is closed. What if Peter sees it? 7 minutes. I sit, terrified, fear coursing through me. 8 minutes now. Could I lure him away? I have no idea how. Just wait? He has to finish up soon, doesn't he? 9 minutes. I'm frozen, unable to move. I force myself to push back from my chair, stand. I'll say I forgot something. The tumbler. Then I'll knock it over, toward the computer, pull out the drive when I'm down on the floor to pick it up. A flash in front of me draws my attention, a change in color, in contrast. My screen goes black, just for an instant. I spin around, look down the row of cubicles, see other screens go black too, in succession, one after another. A swift flicker, running through the vault like an electrical current. Normal screens return. People are looking around, murmuring. What's going on? Oh, God, I bolt for the restricted access door, hold up my badge, press my finger to the reader. Matt's instructions are running through my head. If the drive's still connected when the reset's complete, they'll be able to trace it back to the computer. The door opens just as the lock disengages, just as I start to push, and I almost lose my balance, practically fall into Peter. Vivian, he says, startled. He pushes up his glasses on the bridge of his nose. Cup, I forgot my cup, I say quickly. Too quickly. He shoots me a quizzical look, one that's tinged with suspicion. But it doesn't matter right now. Nothing matters but getting to that flash drive, pulling it out. I move out of his way, wait for him to pass. Every fraction of a second that he doesn't, feeling like torture. Finally, he steps out of the room and I enter, shut the door behind me. I'm on the floor an instant later, yanking out the flash drive, then finding my way to the tumbler, unscrewing the bottom, placing the drive back in, screwing the bottom back on. And then I collapse in the chair. Utterly and completely spent, my whole body is shaking. I can't catch my breath. The terror stays even after the shaking stops, and I don't know why. It should go away. I have the flash drive. I'm safe, right? There's no way the reset was complete. And yet I'm filled with a strange sensation that I'm not safe. Even if this works exactly the way it should. It doesn't take long for the room full of analysts to determine that all work from the past 2 days has been erased. Everyone's commiserating over lost documents, PowerPoint slides. Word quickly spreads that the outage is system-wide. Conspiracy theories abound. Everything from foreign intelligence services to hackers to disgruntled IT employees. Peter's walking from cubicle to cubicle, checking to see if all his analysts' accounts were similarly affected. I hear the quiet conversations, hear him approaching. When he gets to my cubicle, he stands for a long moment, just watching me, silent. His face is expressionless, but somehow it still sends fear flowing through me. Same, Vivian?